Medical traumas can happen to anyone, from children to the elderly. Thankfully, there's life-saving level 1 trauma care at University Medical Center of El Paso. Our nationally renowned trauma surgeons, neurosurgeons, and nurses are equipped with the most advanced, specialized technology in our industry. So when it comes to life-saving, expert care, our community relies on UMC, our region's only level 1 trauma center. At UMC, we care for El Paso.
December 4th, 2001. The man behind a chilling crime that stunned the El Paso community was arrested. It was past midnight as reporters watched and cameras rolled when David Renteria was escorted from the El Paso Police Headquarters. He was handcuffed behind his back as detectives led him to a squad car that would take him downtown to the jail. Renteria was charged with capital murder in the death of Alexandra Flores, the 5-year-old who had gone missing more than 2 weeks earlier from the Lower Valley Walmart. The little girl's body was found the next morning, and Renteria was ultimately convicted and sentenced to death. That sentence has now been carried out.
It took 22 years, but the time came, and it is done now. We finally can truly begin to heal.
I'm Stephanie Valle with KVIA ABC 7 in El Paso, Texas. I served as a media witness to the execution of David Renteria in Huntsville, Texas. The final punishment in this episode of Borderland Crimes. November 16th, 2023, the date the state of Texas marked on the calendar for David Renteria to be executed. It's 2 days shy of the 22nd anniversary of Alexandra Flores' death. She went missing from Walmart on November 18th, 2001, as her family was holiday shopping. Her partially burned body was found in a parking structure across town the next morning. The autopsy stated, the 5-year-old girl had been hit on the head twice and strangled. Renteria was on death row for 20 years. An El Paso jury convicted him in 2003 of capital murder and sentenced him to death. He successfully appealed the punishment in 2006. An appellate court found that the trial jury wasn't made aware of his statement of remorse. But a second jury in 2008 came to the same conclusion, sentencing Renteria once again to lethal injection. Texas death row inmates are locked up in a maximum security prison called the Polunsky Unit. It's roughly 75 miles north of Houston in a town called Livingston. And when they're set to be executed, the inmates are then transported to the Huntsville Prison, which is about an hour drive west of Livingston. So that's where I was headed the morning of November 16th. Getting to Huntsville meant flying from El Paso to Houston, then driving an hour and a half north on I-45 into the town. Huntsville's quaint. It's a college town of about 46,000, home to Sam Houston State University. Its affiliation with the facility where all state death row inmates are executed is not its only distinction. A fine mist hung over Huntsville, blotting out the sun, and the constant southeast Texas humidity made the air feel chillier than 62 degrees. The prison campus emerged into view after a 5-minute drive past a Starbucks through a tree-lined residential neighborhood. It was quiet. A delivery truck was parked outside the prison walls. Guards and the delivery crew were lingering by the entrance. There was absolutely no sign that morning of what was going to happen behind the red brick walls that evening.
He has a family.
It wasn't until the late afternoon, maybe an hour or two before the execution, when the protesters arrived outside the prison.
And that family will be the new crime victims' family, because they will be the victims of the state of Texas murdering their loved one.
An older woman with short gray hair, a microphone, and a loudspeaker stood in the street alongside the prison, now blocked off to traffic. She wore a yellow shirt that read, "Abolish the death penalty." She carried a sign made from yellow poster board. David Renteria's mugshot was taped in the top left corner. The sign read, "Stop the execution." A handful of members of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement milled around a table beside a row of protest signs, all with a similar message.
These might be their last visits. We call this state to stop these legal lynchings.
The argument against executing Renteria was on the movement's website, and it focused on his persistent claim of innocence. He had insisted that a member of the Barrio Azteca gang approached him in the Walmart and told him to bring Alexandra to them, but that they made Renteria dispose of her body. He said that he was remorseful about his role in Alexandra's kidnapping. Renteria initially told El Paso police that he never saw Alexandra in the store. Then, he said, he only led her out of the Walmart to the gang members, and that he had nothing to do with her death. El Paso police say they looked into his story that he helped the Aztecas as a repayment of debt that he owed them. Renteria said they protected him while he was behind bars on indecency with a child years earlier. But police didn't find evidence that Renteria interacted with the Barrio Azteca while behind bars or in the store. But they did see Renteria on the store surveillance video passing Alexandra in an aisle, then turning around and following her. She had wandered away from her family during their shopping trip. And they were seen on video together leaving the store, Renteria wearing a baseball cap a few feet ahead of the little girl in a red dress. Alexandra's DNA was found in his vehicle, which a Walmart security guard noticed idling in the parking lot the day of the kidnapping. And Renteria's palm print was found on a bag wrapped around Alexandra's head. Months before the scheduled execution, I submitted a request through the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, or TDCJ, asking Renteria if I could interview him. He declined. It was the final hour before the execution. I waited with the other reporters in an office across from the prison. There were five of us serving as media witnesses, two others from El Paso from print and Spanish TV media, one from Huntsville, and one from the Associated Press. At 5:26 p.m., the TDCJ spokeswoman popped her head into the room. She said Renteria's attorneys had filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court, meaning we would have to wait. I wondered what this meant for the whole process, and she told me, "We can't act if there's an appeal pending a ruling." Another state employee mentioned the execution order and death warrant would only be good for this day, meaning if the execution were to happen, the Supreme Court would need to rule by 11:59 p.m. By now, all other options were exhausted. Renteria's attorneys argued the execution should be delayed because, one, Renteria was denied his constitutional right to due process in September when a lower court refused to pull the execution from the calendar and allow his attorney to review the district attorney's case file, and two, not delaying the execution and allowing the file to be reviewed would lead to irreparable harm. El Paso District Attorney Bill Hicks was in Huntsville to witness the execution. He responded to the allegations in the appeal that he denied access to the office's case file.
Stephanie, the appeals are just part of the process. Obviously, I didn't agree with some of their arguments. I didn't agree with some of the allegations they made, but I think that the courts all made the right and just decisions denying all of their appeals, all the way through the last-minute Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, which called down that they were denying the petition for certiorari, the request by the defense to hear, for the Supreme Court to hear their case.
Around 6:30 p.m., half an hour after the execution was supposed to happen, the Supreme Court denied considering Renteria's request. Before the reporters were driven to the prison, we were searched for any recording devices, from the top of my head to the bare soles of my feet. Only a pen and paper were allowed. We entered the back of the prison as a light rain fell and walked down a long hallway lined with old, unused cells, then turned a corner into a small room. Two of Alexandra Flores' siblings were standing there, Sandra and Ignacio Frausto, two of the oldest of eight children. 2 years ago, Alexandra's mother told her kids she didn't want to attend and give any more of her time to Renteria. Two other women were also in the room. One was a victim of Renteria when she was a girl in 1992. She was there with her mother. He was convicted of indecency with a child in that case, and he had to register as a sex offender, which is why Renteria's palm prints were on file, and how police found him after Alexandra's murder. As I walked into the room, I heard Sandra say, "He's looking at us," and that's when I realized that the back wall of this small room was actually a barred window offering a view into the execution chamber. David Renteria lay on a gurney, his arms splayed out and prepared with an IV line. A white sheet came up to his chest. I could see under the sheet he was wearing a white prison uniform, and he had indeed turned his head in our direction. The reflection off the glass in his thick black frames partially obstructed his eyes from view. A woman, presumably a jail employee, stood at his feet, and his spiritual advisor, only her hands visible to me, stood at his head. Her hands were on his shoulders. The jail warden stood at the corner of the room, moving in and out of my line of sight. Sandra started to sob, and her brother reached out to comfort her. Michael Grachik with the Associated Press was with Renteria's witnesses, and I asked him in a virtual interview days later about what he saw.
When we entered the chamber, I believe it was his sister and another, a male, were the two personal witnesses. His mother was on the list, but she did not appear. And there were, I think, two others on the list, and they did not appear. I don't know the relationship of the man, the male who was in there, but I know that he referred to the woman in there as his sister. So I'm assuming that was correct. She was quite emotional. She when we walked in, she either fell to her knees or sat down on the floor on the carpet in the room. And as you know, it's a relatively small room. They would have been the first people to enter that side of it. She was again quite distraught. She was offered a chair, which she declined, and then she stood up and walked a little bit, or stood a little bit closer to the window, which meant she was perhaps 3 to 5 feet away from Renteria, separated, of course, by the window and the jail bars that are within the window. And that's kind of what we saw. I think he nodded to her, or he said something that was going to be all right.
From where I was standing, about 5 feet from the window, I could see Renteria's lips moving. I could tell he was looking at someone in the other witness area. He appeared to be mouthing the words, "It's okay, I love you."
A prison official opened the door to the chamber from the back and told the warden that she may proceed. And then the execution proceeded.
There was some silence before the warden asked if Renteria had anything to say. "Yes," he said, as the microphone anchored to the ceiling and positioned above his mouth transmitted his final statement into the witness rooms. He began to sing a hymn in Spanish, praising the Lord. Renteria had been raised Catholic, and someone actually told me recently he'd been their catechism teacher when they were children. I noticed Sandra was visibly upset. She turned her head from the window, and again Ignacio turned to her as if to comfort her. After he finished the hymn, Renteria began speaking, leading a prayer in a manner often heard at the beginning of Catholic Mass. And then he began to sing in English a psalm about those who seek and offer mercy. After he finished singing, he began to speak. A voice actor is reading his statement.
I call upon peace to the family of the victim.
Renteria paused and turned his head towards the room where Alexandra's brother and sister stood.
There is not a day that goes by that I do not think about the fateful events of that day and what transpired. I pray that the Lord gives you peace. I pray that the Lord gives you what you seek. There are no words to describe what you are going through, and I understand your pain.
He did not mention Alexandra by name, nor did he elaborate further on the events that transpired that day. Then Renteria tilted his head to see his sister and friend.
To my family, I love you. To my family out there, my brothers on death row, or life row.
And here, Renteria sounded wistful.
I love you. To the people that have shown compassion and that have been there for me, you are my true family, and I have been blessed.
Renteria then stared up at the ceiling and continued.
I am a man of many faults. For those that have hurt and caused pain in their life, I beg for forgiveness. Let everyone know I am sorry for all the wrong that I have done. For those that called for me, transgressed against me, and want me murdered, I forgive you. I truly do.
When he emphasized the word murdered, I looked at the Fraustos. Sandra had fixed her gaze on the wall, away from Renteria, practically giving him her back. Ignacio was almost glaring at Renteria. Renteria continued, saying,
I have been blessed by God. In these last 3 to 4 years, something was brought about courageous men of God to make something beautiful. I learned grace. I learned forgiveness. I learned love. I learned to look at others with love, no matter who they are. I learned that there is no redemption above forgiveness. Like Abraham Lincoln said once, that mercy bears richer fruits than any other attributes. I pray one day the message of the Lord would be heard, because the world is hurting and things could be better.
Now he paused briefly and said,
I don't know what else to say to my family. I'm good, I'm strong. I just know that I'm going to be okay. I'm good. I love y'all. I love y'all. I truly do. I will see you in the other world.
He looked away from his family and then spoke to the ceiling.
I'm ready, Warden. Send me home.
He began to pray but didn't get further than saying, Our Father who art in heaven, before interrupting himself. His face scrunched up and he said, I taste it. I taste it. It was the only evidence we could see that the lethal injection was administered. Inside the IV, a single drug, pentobarbital, a narcotic sedative. I saw Renteria's spiritual advisor's hands gripping his shoulders. Renteria attempted to continue the prayer, but began slurring. Then he snored twice as that heavy sedative took effect. Silence in the execution chamber. I could hear crying in the witness room adjacent. The air was still as everyone in the victim's room waited for absolution. A doctor broke the stillness, walking into the chamber, checking Renteria's eyes with a penlight, feeling his neck for a pulse, then listening for a heartbeat with a stethoscope. He pronounced Renteria's time of death at 7:11 p.m. Central Time. As we walked through a low-hanging mist back to the vans, I realized I didn't ever see Renteria's witnesses in person. The separation of the victims and inmates' witnesses is intentional to prevent any conflicts. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice told me Renteria was allowed to choose how his remains were handled, adding that they were picked up. But when I asked what he chose to do and who picked up the remains, the spokeswoman told me she could not disclose that information. State-mandated executions have been legal in Texas in various forms, from hangings to electrocutions to lethal injections, since 1819. There was an 18-month period from 1972 to 74 when executions were not allowed. The U.S. Supreme Court had declared capital punishment cruel and unusual. But the Texas Penal Code was revised and executions resumed in 1982. Michael Grachik wasn't in the room for that one, but he has reported on almost all of the 580 executions in Texas since then as a reporter for the AP.
I can't think of any other power or authority that government has than the power to kill you or to kill me. And if we're going to have a law that allows the government to do that, then I think it's extremely important that someone be in there who doesn't have a stake in the outcome, that is not emotionally involved in the participants. So the advantage I have in being in there so many times is that if something strays from the procedure or the routine, and I hesitate to call it routine because I don't think it should be routine anytime it's government or the state takes someone's life, but routine meaning the procedure, if something is different in the procedure, it's important for someone like me or like you to point out or to ask or to question why, and to ensure that this is being done appropriately and with a certain amount of professionalism and with dignity. But yeah, it's important for someone like me or like you to be in there just to ensure that it's done right or correctly according to the law.
Shortly after the execution, the family of Alexandra Flores wanted to give a statement. We met them inside another building on the prison campus, this one more welcoming, with warm light spilling out onto the red brick porch that was lined with white columns. Sandra and Ignacio Frausto walked up to the podium set up in the foyer. Ignacio was holding a collage of photos of Alexandra, the baby of the 8 children. Sandra spoke first.
Baby sister, we are 2 days short of your anniversary. 22 years ago, you were robbed of what would have been a beautiful life at 27 years old. And as we stand here today, now you can truly rest in peace. Your contagious laugh, your perfect smile, and your mischievous but sweet, innocent personality will forever echo and live in our hearts.
Then Ignacio stepped in. He was gripping the podium, racked with emotion.
Just want to emphasize, I'm holding our sister's photos, happy moments.
Ignacio held up the collage, then handed it to his sister and took a breath before continuing.
This is what our baby sister, who she was, right here. I want to emphasize, you know, because I do want to recognize her, not forget about her. And basically, I just want to, you know, thank everybody who helped our family get through this trauma, through all of this. The Criminal Justice Division, TDCJ, for helping and guiding us through everything here. It's been a tough week. I want to thank the law enforcement agencies who investigated the case, who helped federal agencies, El Paso Police Department, the Sheriff's Office, DPS, Border Patrol, all the law enforcement personnel, the community and the press, the community for helping us search for our baby sister when this incident occurred, and the press for helping us bring this to light and airing, you know, to help look for our baby sister. The El Paso District Attorney's Office, from Mr. Jaime Esparza to Mr. T.A. Hicks, now. Without the prosecution, we wouldn't be here today. The courts of criminal appeals, a lot of
work goes into the appeal process, and a lot of the people in the community don't recognize that or realize how rigorous work goes into the appeals process. And to our friends and family back home, you know, everybody was there for us. The El Paso community was there for us. And Mom, it took 22 years, but the time came, and it is done now.
Ignacio seemed to lose the strength to stand. He leaned heavily on the podium and tried to compose himself.
We finally can truly begin to heal, truly heal. 22 years of wondering what was gonna happen. Thank you.
I had interviewed Ignacio about his baby sister a few days before the execution. Ignacio wasn't there at the Walmart with his family that day. He was 14 years old, playing basketball with his older brother. When he told me that, he paused.
And that's something we all beat ourselves up for it.
Ignacio said when he and his brother found out from their father Alexandra was missing, they went to the Walmart to help look for her.
So on the way there, you know, I kind of felt like, this is getting serious, you know, we haven't received a call back saying we found her. Once we got there, we saw that Walmart was being evacuated, people weren't being let out of the parking lot. So immediately my older brother and I were, you know, just driving up and down the parking lot, just looking into cars. We even went through the back of Walmart, and so the search continued till like 3-4 in the morning. We expanded our search to, there's a canal, like a drainage canal in the rear of Walmart, right by the train tracks. I remember walking the train tracks, walking by the canal, going down to the port of entry, the Zaragoza port of entry, and standing there, literally checking every car going south, doing that. Yeah.
It's just horrible.
He didn't want to go home without knowing his little sister was back where she belonged. He may not have been at Walmart with his family that day, but now, as a father himself, he can be there for his sister at the execution.
I want to see it through. I was too young, not having the maturity that I have now, when we were going through the trial, to comprehend and grasp everything.
Now, Ignacio is the deputy chief investigator for the El Paso District Attorney's Office. He said he's been working with the DA's office for 19 years. It's a career path sparked by his interaction with the criminal justice system.
What this office does for this community, it's extremely important. Extremely important. I love what I do. That's what makes me successful at what I do. But the biggest, I guess, sense of fulfillment position where I was at is being a victim advocate. It's a really tough position to be in, especially with our background, my background, and what my family went through. It's really tough, but it made me stronger to help others that walked through our doors here.
Ignacio managed to turn his family's tragedy into purpose and meaning in his work. Nothing will bring back Alexandra, but hopefully this family's wound can finally heal. Borderland Crimes is a podcast recorded, written, edited, and produced by me, Stephanie Valle. I covered this case for the podcast on its 20th anniversary, and you can still listen to that episode for more background, including the incredible story of how detectives linked the evidence to the killer. You can find it in this podcast feed. And I shared the photos that Alexandra's family used in their collage to show reporters during the news conference in Huntsville on KVIA.com. You can find them in the podcast section of the website. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe, rate, and review.
My sinuses were clogged, my head was throbbing, and my muscles ached. I really didn't have the energy to drive to see a physician. With University Medical Center of El Paso's telehealth services, I stayed in the comfort of my home and consulted virtually with my UMC provider. No traffic, parking, or crowded doctor's offices. Better health is a phone call away. I'm happy I called UMC.
Call us today for an appointment at 915-790-5700. At UMC, we care for El Paso.